at 3:06 p.m. Tuesday, May 18, 2021, in the Max Grunberg Room of the Capitol. Members present, from my left to my right, Representatives Vance, Kaufman, Story, Klayman, and myself, Chair Christ Tompkins, giving us five members present and therefore a quorum. Online is Sophia with House Records, and we also have Nate in the back of the room with LAO facilitating. Thank you both, Sophia and Nate. We really appreciate it. We have a number of items on today's agenda, ending the 2021 legislative session with a productive bang. And the items listed in order are House Bill 177, third hearing from Representative Tuck. We have HB 95, a de facto first hearing from the governor on election investigations. HB 158 from Representative Prox relating to contributions to the general fund via PFDs. HB 94 from Representative Foster relating to prohibited commercial lease provisions. And finally, HB 31 relating to daylight saving time being a year-round affair. Representative Tuck is not here, so I'm going to roll that bill to the bottom. Next up is House Bill 95, and Corey Mills is here, so we'll hear the bill. Welcome, Deputy Attorney General Mills, and for the committee's reference, also online is Tom Flynn with the Department of Law and AAG, and it looks as though John Haley, also with DOL, is here. And Representative Tuck, we'll take your bill up second because we just dove in, and but welcome to the committee. So this is a first hearing, and I think in due time, Gail Finumiai may be available for questions, although I don't see her online right now, just again for the committee's reference. But welcome, Deputy Attorney General Mills. Congratulations on the position, I think a little bit belatedly, but congratulations. And please go ahead and put yourself on record and present the legislation.
Well, Chair Christ Tompkins and members of the House State Affairs Committee, for the record, Corey Mills, Deputy Attorney General for the Department of Law. Glad to be here in person with all of you. So House Bill 95 is, I'm going to go through it, and I know you have a lot on your agenda, so I'm going to try not to dwell too much, but it's a bill relating to creating civil investigation tools to look into potential election violations. So the purpose of HB 95 is to authorize the Attorney General to conduct civil investigations into election law violations and to bring civil enforcement actions if a violation is found. Basically, right now, in the current statutory scheme, what you have is if the Division of Elections identifies any sort of suspicious behavior, the only option it really has is to do a criminal referral and then, you know, move on with the election. And as I think we all know, criminal investigations can take a while. The standard of proof is quite high, and it takes a lot of resources. So the thought behind this bill was to create another set of tools that could be used by the division if it encounters suspicious behavior. And that's to create a civil investigation referral that would go to the Attorney General to use the same types of tools that we use actually in the consumer protection realm. So basically you can force someone to answer questions, to give you documents to determine whether there's been some form of a violation. One thing to be clear on, though, is this is really just giving us the investigative tools. Any ultimate determination would still have to go to court. So it's not, we're not giving any sort of penalty authority to the Attorney General. We just want to be able to look into it, determine what the evidence is, and then we can always go get a court order to enforce an injunction or to bring some sort of fines if there's a really bad actor. So the advantages to a civil investigation, I sort of mentioned this previously. So a civil investigation can react more quickly than a criminal investigation. And our hope is that for at least some of these, you could actually investigate within the time frame of an election in case there's something that needs to be addressed, like I said, more quickly than a criminal investigation could. The evidentiary standard is basically a more likely than not standard instead of a beyond a reasonable doubt standard. So you also have a different standard of evidence you're looking at. And then you can hopefully get information to the division that can help them in their determinations on during the election season. So examples of why this came up, because I understand that the 2020 election season was particularly contentious and there were a lot of issues raised. What I just want to make clear is that we actually had this idea come up previously. We actually made this proposal prior to the 2020 election, so it was already in process before that had even happened. Some examples that kind of, there are others, but the ones that kind of are more public that I can talk about. House District 15 in 2018, I think most people are aware of that. Basically, the Division of Elections in around July, I think, of that year, started seeing these suspicious absentee ballot applications. They started kind of putting them aside. But again, all they could do is refer them for criminal investigation, which is exactly what the division did and what they should have done. The question is, if we had had these civil investigative tools, could we have looked into it more quickly to actually, before the primary election was over, determine what was actually going on, or at least before the general? But instead, it was referred criminally, and as you know, charges weren't brought for 2 years. And in fact, the main actor ended up passing away, so they were never able to kind of go down that route completely. The second one I'd mention is signature gathering for the oil and gas initiative. So there were complaints brought up to the lieutenant governor that certain petition gatherers were getting paid more than the statute allowed. We couldn't even figure that out. So we couldn't even go and find out, unless someone just wanted to hand us their contract for signature gathering, how much they were getting and determine, is there really a violation of the law here? In the end, this was litigated after the fact, so the lieutenant governor certified it, and it was brought to court, and there's still a question of what the interpretation of the statute is. The Alaska Supreme Court still has to come out with its full decision. As you know, it was certified. It was on the ballot. But if we had been able to look into that ahead of time and get the evidence, we might have been able to help the lieutenant governor actually make a decision of, was there any wrongdoing, and have that determined instead of having to draw it out right up to the election.
Representative Story.
Thank you, Chair Kreis Tompkins. Just verify for me, mm-hmm. I appreciate you explaining all of this to me now, and that you're looking for bad actors who might try to be corrupting the process and the election. But we know through our election process that every ballot is verified and it's cured and all of that. So the election was fine. But we're just trying to look at something now if we see a bad actor coming up and want to stop that. But we have processes in place where we verify all the signatures and that.
So through the chair, Rep Story, I would say that's absolutely correct. And we have all the confidence in the 2020 election, for example. I will say, going back to 2018, they were able to set aside those suspicious ballots, but they couldn't necessarily say they didn't meet all of the qualifications. There were just indications that there may have been some fraudulent activity. But those ballots didn't make a difference in that election. What we're trying to prevent is, what if you had a closer election and you had suspicious ballots? We're afraid that there's a trust and integrity problem that could be addressed if we're actually able to find out what happened there. Was there bad actors? Maybe there wasn't. And then we can have that evidence as well. So those are just kind of some examples, because I think people throw around fraud readily in the elections context. And there are some examples where it is true, and there are some examples where it's not true. So I wanted to point out the ones that we've particularly highlighted. So in terms of how this bill would work, there's kind of three ways an investigation could start. One is, the division could just refer, let's say with the suspicious absentee ballot applications, the division would just refer that directly to the Attorney General if they felt like there was enough suspicious activity to warrant an investigation. The second way is the Attorney General could start an investigation of his or her own accord as well if, for some reason, we got evidence of some sort of election violation. And then the third way would be a complaint process, which sounds more formal than it really is. It would just be a way for us to intake public concerns about violations. And these would go to the Division of Elections. I think if you know how the Division of Elections operates during election season, they get a lot of these already. This would just funnel them in a specific way and give us a process for which ones should be investigated and which ones shouldn't. So the division would review the complaints in consultation with the Attorney General's office, which is, they almost do nothing without consulting with us. And then they would determine whether the complaint warrants investigation or doesn't. And there's specific standards set out in the statute that will be, we'll highlight in the sectional. If they determine the complaint warrants investigation, then it's sent to the Attorney General's office, and the Attorney General has discretion to conduct the investigation. So this is similar to consumer protection complaints, because if you get an inundation, or even police complaints, if you get an inundation, you have to be able to prioritize what you're looking into at any given time. And so the next part I'm actually going to hand over to Assistant Attorney General Tom Flynn to talk about what an investigation looks like.
Mr. Flynn.
Thank you, Corey. Through the chair, this is Tom Flynn, Assistant Attorney General. So just to give you an idea of what the investigation would look like, it would begin potentially with these more informal type steps. So these can be things like voluntary interviews, site visits. In one of Corey's examples, this could be going out and talking to canvassers. And notably, throughout this process, it would be an investigator who was doing the investigating rather than an attorney, so that an attorney doesn't become a witness throughout that process. And then on the next slide, you could go to some more formal investigative steps, and these would include subpoenas for interviews and subpoenas for documents. Some of those could go to the targets of the investigation, but they could also go to those who aren't the target, so witnesses and things like that. And then at the end of this investigation, which may continue for some time, as Corey explained, the AG could dismiss the complaint, could go to court for some sort of remedy, or actually throughout this process could refer the complaint to law enforcement and to the criminal division. So with that, I'll go into a sectional of House Bill 95. So it's titled An Act Relating to Elections and Election Investigations. It has one section, which adds a new section to Title 15, Chapter 56. Subsection A allows anyone to file a written complaint alleging a violation of election laws or regulations. That complaint would be due to the Division of Elections 30 days after the election or 30 days after the alleged violation, whichever is later. And just to note, in Senate Judiciary, we supported an amendment to expand and clarify this timeline, that 30-day timeline. Subsection B directs the division to refer alleged violations of campaign finance laws or regulations to APOC. So this is how it currently works, and it would stay that way. The division would have the discretion to refer all other complaints to the Attorney General. And if the complaint was incomplete, frivolous, or didn't actually allege a violation of election law, then the division could either ask for more information or just dismiss the complaint without referring it. Subsection C allows the Attorney General to investigate an alleged violation identified by a complaint by the division or by the Attorney General, General's office itself. Subsection D authorizes the Attorney General to conduct the investigation by subpoenaing witnesses or documents, by holding hearings under oath, by sending interrogatories, which are questions to be answered under oath, and by examining records. In Senate Judiciary, just to note, we supported a pretty substantial amendment to explain this process a bit more and also speed it up to add some timelines. Subsection E provides that the records and intelligence resulting from the investigation are not public records, except that the Attorney General may issue public statements that describe activities that violate election laws. Subsection F directs the Attorney General to inform the division of the results of the investigation and also provides the option to submit a report. And if a complaint against a state agency or state employee has merit, the division will make reasonable efforts to take corrective action. And again, the results and the records and intelligence resulting from the investigation remain confidential unless they're submitted to a court or used by the division. Subsection G allows the Attorney General to sue for injunctive relief after the investigation, provided the investigation is not a violation of campaign finance laws. Subsection H allows the Attorney General to seek a civil penalty of not more than $25,000 per violation, along with reasonable fees and costs, including the cost of the investigation. Here again, we supported an amendment in Senate Judiciary to change the terminology of civil penalty to fine. And then finally, subsections I and J allow the division and the Attorney General to adopt regulations to implement this section. Subsection K clarifies that the person filing the complaint may also file a complaint in court, a separate complaint, and then subsection I defines frivolous state agency and state employee. And that's the sectional. Thank you.
If there are any questions, we're happy to answer them.
Questions from the committee? Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking on subsection G and H, and it talks about after an investigation, the Attorney General has reason to believe that a person has engaged, is engaging, or is about to engage in an act or practice in violation of this title. And I was wondering if you could provide an instance that about with the words about to engage that the Attorney General would have authority to be able to act on someone who hasn't done anything yet. That seems concerning, especially since there could be up to a $25,000 violation. So obviously you had something in mind. Could you talk about that?
So through the chair, Representative Vance, I would go back to, for example, the suspicious absentee ballot applications that came in. So there may have already been a violation there, but if that application, say there were applications that were processed and the person got an absentee ballot, if they were going to vote it fraudulently, we could try to stop the counting of that vote or, you know, some other injunction if we had evidence that they were in that they were violating or actively violating the law. So it's there was probably a bad action before, but there may be the injunction may be enjoining some behavior or action that would take place after. But we would need evidence for a court to order that. I mean, evidence that there was either an ongoing violation or there was absolutely going to be a violation in order to get an injunction granted.
Thank you.
Additional questions? What's the thinking, Representative Kaufman's in the queue, of civil penalty versus fee? Is there a substantive difference between those two?
So, Chair Kreis-Tompkins, this was actually a discussion that came up with the court system. Apparently, civil fines are imposed by a court. Civil penalties are usually an administrative action. And we took our language from the Consumer Protection Act, which apparently is outdated and should use the term civil fines, but has not been updated. And so that's the reason the request for the change was made.
Interesting. So as far as the Consumer Protection Act goes, if someone is found to violate the Consumer Protection Act right now, that act uses the word fees, and therefore technically penalty can only be meted out by the courts?
So, Chair Kreis-Tompkins, my understanding is the court still enforces, and so the Consumer Protection Act uses civil penalty, and it should say civil fine. Mm-hmm. It's if we put civil penalty in here, the court would still enforce it. They were just asking to clean up the statutes so that the terms are used more appropriately to the way the court views when they're fines and when they're penalties. And apparently penalties are more like an administrative action. I'm trying to think of a department, but you know, sometimes departments actually have the ability to issue the penalty, and then someone can appeal that. And what we set this up, that we would have to go to court and have the court impose the fine, partly because we felt like it was an appropriate check on the process to not create a whole new unit within the Department of Law for a whole hearing process and everything else that was needed.
And let the record reflect, Representative Tarr joined us at 3:26. Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair to Ms. Mills, I was just wondering if, like, the best practices in other states, are we modeling something that's been benchmarked and so that we know, hey, this is a good model to follow? Thank you.
So, Rep. Kaufman, through the chair, that is a really interesting question because we did a lot of research last summer looking at all the other 50 states, and they are all over the map. So, and part of it is elections are dealt with very differently. Our state is very centralized, as we know. A lot of states do it at the county level. So some of these types of powers, these powers do exist, I think, in around 25 states. And some of them are in a board of elections. They actually have a board that runs their elections or oversees them at the state level. Some are with the Attorney General, and some are with the Secretary of State, or in our case, it would be the Lieutenant Governor. In looking at all the different models, and some are, you know, pick out specific laws, kind of like we have our Public Offices Commission, and that already has a very finite world in which they deal with campaign finance. So some were broad, some were narrow. It was all over the place. We felt like, looking at our state, our Attorney General's office already does these types of investigations in another area in consumer protection. So we felt like it was more efficient and effective to put it someplace where we already knew how to do this and had investigators that are trained in how to do this instead of building it within the division. And then in terms of scope, again, it was a feeling like we don't want to miss something, and it's better to have the powers, because this is simply to be able to investigate, than to, you know, go through the statutes and pick out each one and what sort of penalty you want with it and what sort of tools you want with it. We felt it was better to have the tools and be able to apply them in a broad range of situations.
Follow up. Thank you. I guess it's more of a comment than a question, but it just seems like something most people would think we had something like this in place, and it's interesting to find out that it's a gap. So I'm glad to see this. Thank you.
Other questions? What would, for the lay people among us, injunctive relief look like under this proposal?
No, that's a great question, Chair. So injunctive relief is basically the court declaring that a certain violation had occurred, and then the remedy isn't damages. You know, it's not monetary. It's more saying, and you have to stop. So it's telling someone you violated the law and you need to stop.
And if someone has violated the law and the court finds that that violation has occurred and provides injunctive relief, and someone declines to be enjoined, what then happens? Where ultimately does a stick, hard stick, come into the process?
Yeah, so Chair, first of all, you do have the civil fines that can be imposed. And second of all, you can be in contempt of court. And at that point, you can have really severe penalties depending on how long and what the court wants to impose. But you could end up having to go into custody if you are in contempt of court.
And circling to the provision, gosh, let me pull up the section. I think it's section B, subsection B, relating to APOC. Mm-hmm. Forgive me, as this might be a restatement of the sectional, but this is basically saying any campaign finance violation goes to APOC, not us. Not us, says the Department of Law.
Correct.
Has there been discussion with APOC on the construction of that division of responsibility?
Chair Kreis-Tompkins, I don't think we had a specific discussion. Our thought was APOC handles this well. They know what they're doing. They have very specific penalties and very specific laws that the division knows nothing about. So let's keep campaign finance where it is and keep everything else that the division actually oversees. That's what we're focused on.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions? Representative Vance is in a pensive trance. But that's not a question. So thank you very much, Deputy Attorney General Mills. Appreciate this legislation and looking forward to taking it up for consideration this interim and or next year. There's a bevy of elections related bills, and I want to make sure they all get consideration and a running start next year. And I think this is an important proposal.
Thank you, Chair. Appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you. So that is the first or second, depending on how you're counting, item on today's agenda. Let's circle back to House Bill 177 from Representative Tuck. And we're going to do a little bit of amendment jujitsu today. In the last hearing, we adopted amendment number 1A.1. And for reasons that can be explained, I think we want to undo that action and reconsider a revised version of that amendment, amendment number 2A.2. So in order to enable consideration of amendment number 2, Representative Klayman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that we rescind the action of the House State Affairs Committee in adopting Amendment 1 to House Bill 177, labeled 32-LS0369/A.1.
Seeing and hearing no objection, amendment number, passage of amendment number 1 is rescinded, and as I am officially the sponsor of amendment number 1, I am going to withdraw amendment number 1. That takes us to amendment number 2, which I'm carrying on behalf of the bill sponsor, and I will move amendment number 2.
Object for discussion.
And there's an objection. Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for allowing me to go over amendment number 1 to number 2 to House Bill 177. For the record, I'm Representative Chris Tuck from South Central Anchorage, District 23. So what we did with the next amendment is there is and Representative Eastman had brought this up in the very first meeting about funded otherwise funded activity in line 6, and then going down to line 16 on the original amendment, on line 16, the additional activity, and then the commencement of the expenditures. So what we did is we unified the terms, and actually Ledge Legal said, yes, this is a good correction to be able to correct that, so that instead of, we say revised program or project. And the original amendment also had program and project, but then did not have program and project spelled out uniformly throughout the amendment. So we revised that. And to make that correction, since we had already passed amendment number 1, it wouldn't have been appropriate to do an amendment to the amendment amended deal. So thank you for entertaining the idea of withdrawing amendment number 1 to offer a revised amendment, that being amendment number 2. So those are the two changes.
Thank you. So in effect, amendment number 2 is a slightly more explicitly stated, less sort of room for loosey-goosey executive branch interpretation version of amendment number 1.
Yes, that's correct.
Questions from the committee? Representative Klayman, do you maintain your objection?
I do not. I'll withdraw the objection.
Is there further objection to amendment number 2? Seeing and hearing none, amendment number 2 is adopted, and given that we entertain final consideration more or less of the bill at the last hearing, I'll turn to Representative Klayman for a motion.
I move to report House Bill 177, version 32-LS0369/A as amended out of committee with individual recommendations and the accompanying fiscal note.
Seeing and hearing no objection, House Bill 177 moves from committee. Thank you very much,
Thank you. Tuck. Thank you very much, everyone. Appreciate it.
So that dispenses of the second item on today's agenda. That takes us to item 3 of 5, House Bill 158, PFD contributions to the general fund, excuse me. Not to the permanent fund, but that would be an interesting amendment to this bill. Welcome, Representative Prox, to the committee. Thrilled to have you, and please go ahead and present the legislation at your leisure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to introduce House Bill 158. Mr. Chairman, hundreds of Alaskans have testified that they would be happy to give up their permanent fund dividend in order to maintain state services. But when I checked with the Department of Revenue only a couple of years ago, about 105 people had actually done that. And this could be because it's currently it takes four steps to accomplish the task. You have to apply for the dividend. You have to choose to receive a check instead of a direct deposit. You have to receive the check, and then you have to mail it back to the Department of Revenue, which seems pretty simple, but I'm not sure I can even find stamps at my house, so it's complicated. House Bill 158 would simplify the process to just checking a box on the electronic PFD application, and this should result in considerably more dividends returned to the general fund, and that would help the balance of income problem that we have here. And the House Bill 158 itself is essentially just a copy of a bill that was introduced in the other body in the 31st legislature and was passed through, I believe it was the Finance Committee. And so we're just going from there. So I encourage the State Affairs Committee to consider the bill and recommend passage. And if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Representative Prox. Any questions from the committee? I should note that Bobby Scherer, Operations Director, I think is her title with the Permanent Fund Dividend Division, is on the line for questions as well. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just looking on the fiscal note. So it just looks like so far they haven't given us any estimate of how many people might participate, and I guess that might just be a difficult thing because they would just maybe have to pick a number. But it sounded like you had done some research before, and there were, you know, this small number of people who actually went through all those steps. In those conversations with the permanent fund, were they able to give you any other information or, like, you know, oh, but we get, you know, dozens more calls about it and that kind of thing? I'm just kind of curious if we have any ballpark or thoughts on that.
Right. Thank you. Through the chair, didn't go that far. I thought about it, but to me, it really doesn't make a whole lot of difference. I think we will get, for sure, we'll get enough checks to cover the cost of setting up the program, and then anything after that is net income. So I have no idea, but I think if we just, my recommendation is to just set it up, see what happens, and go from there.
Thank you.
Representative Clayman.
So, are you focusing this on people who want to apply for a dividend and keep some of the money and return some of the money, or focusing on people who just want to return the whole thing? Because other than wanting to be on the list to be picked for a jury and some of the other things that come with registering with the permanent fund, I don't know why you would go through the effort if you were just going to return the whole thing.
Right. Thank you. Through the chair, the mechanics of the bill would be that you could donate essentially to the state general fund in $25 increments. So however much up to, of course, the value of the dividend that year. And
follow up.
Mm-hmm.
So we get taxed by the federal government for our dividends.
Yep.
Would we still get taxed for the full amount, even though we return some to the general fund?
That is not entirely clear. and that was a debate when it went through the Finance Committee a couple years ago. And it, you know, some of the donations to nonprofits are tax deductible. If it was an income tax, it would be tax deductible, but it wasn't entirely clear that this would be a tax deductible donation. But again, I think given that it is somebody's choice to whether or not to donate to the general fund, it requires a disclaimer noting that you have to check with your tax advisor to see if this would be tax deductible. But as long as it's a voluntary donation for purposes of this bill and for our interest as the legislature for the state, it really doesn't matter to me. Let somebody else make that decision.
Just a comment and follow-up. Mm-hmm. I do know from a tax standpoint, if I give $100 to Pick Click Give and the dividend is $1,000, from the federal government standpoint, my income is $1,000 and I have a deduction for $100 on my federal taxes, but I don't.
Right.
It's not viewed as $900 as income. It's not a pre-tax deduction. And so I would be curious if you're now giving the money to the state, whether
right.
you're actually going to get taxed on the $1,000 or the $500 or whatever the dividend is, and then if you give it back to the state, you pay the tax and you don't keep the money. So I'd be
right.
curious about how that would get treated as a tax matter.
I
yes.
believe, Representative Clayman, you mean the $6,000.
Anyway. I was actually thinking, Mr. Chair, about the $250.
Oh, okay. We'll soon find out. Representative Prox, feel free to respond if you'd like.
Well, yes, to that question, I don't know. I guess I have to be a tax attorney to give a more definitive answer. But I think we should assume that it is not deductible. So if you gave the entire check to the state, you would lose whatever the taxes might be. On the other hand, you could figure out what your tax liability might be and just give the remainder to the state, and then you break even from the standpoint of the individual.
And Representative Prox, I too am curious about the answer to that question. I might suggest consulting legislative, legal, or other outside experts and see if it's possible to maybe get a more definitive
answer. I can do that, and I'll send that back.
Yeah, send to my office and we can distribute to members. Who is the sponsor of the measure in the other body in the 31st legislature?
That was Senator Wilson.
Mm-hmm. And it made it through Senate Finance and
right.
no farther.
It didn't make it further, and I don't know if we adjourned early a couple right. years ago.
Okay. Further questions? Ms. Scherer with Department of Revenue, PFD Division, any comments from an operational perspective on implementation of a measure such as this?
For the chair and committee, my name is Bobby Scherer, and I'm with the Permanent Fund Dividend Division, and I'm the appeals manager. For this, if this bill were to go through, we would modify our electronic application to add a section that would allow contributions to be made to the general fund, as the representative described, in increments of $25 or more up to the total amount of the dividend for that year.
And I'm pulling up the fiscal note for the bill right now, but what all is entailed with rejiggering the application in that manner?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is involved in this process is we actually have done a deep dive into what is needed for this. Our programming manager took a look at this, would be looking at the requirements for gathering of the data, development of the application, testing of the processes, and rolling it out. And the two largest contributing factors are the time needed to modify the online application, excuse me, please, and the MyInfo portal, both about 150 hours each.
And 150 hours each at some billable or internal hourly rate?
to the chair, that would depend on our staffing at the time and whether or not it's billable or internal staff. The time needed for this development and testing, if I could also add, would allow the applicant to have a more effective and less confusing experience and ensures that we've captured the most accurate data.
Could you say a little bit more what you mean by the best possible experience and the most accurate data?
Certainly. When we create the changes to an electronic application, we want the experience for every Alaskan who is applying online to be easy to follow. Click on this to select the ability to donate to the general fund by in the increments of $25, excuse me, and make it an easy experience for them if this bill were to pass.
Okay. Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just curious at this point, what percentage of folks are doing the online application versus the other options? And the online seems very easy. Is it just as easy with the paper applications to add, you know, these additional features and have them be well understood by the applicants?
Through the chair, Representative, I do know the majority of our applicants are online applications, but I couldn't give you that exact number. I apologize. I can get that back to the committee before the next meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And that's not necessary. I'm not so much looking for a specific number, but just trying to think of making sure we sort of cross our T's, dot our I's in terms of all the different ways people would apply. And it sounds like you don't have any concern about the paper application being updated to include a new option.
Through the chair, Representative, the bill actually specifically states that it would be through the electronic permanent fund dividend application.
Okay. So then, if I might.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So in the circumstances for those other folks, this option wouldn't exist. This is just going to be added to the electronic option.
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
What percentage of applicants?
Maybe I do want that number now, actually.
Apply electronically versus in hard copy form, Ms. Scherr?
We can get you that information before the next meeting.
Okay. Do you have a ballpark sense?
I don't want to give you guys anything that's incorrect. That's not something I monitor as the appeals manager. I sincerely apologize.
No, that's okay. And just as a related question, there have been a number of PFD bills in the committee. What is the status on filling the PFD division directorship?
To the chair, that's not an answer that I have for you. I would have to get back with you before the next meeting.
Okay. Yeah, I realize that is not your call. You're doing a great job as the appeals manager. It seems like you're being put into the field of play in a utility player capacity that is it would be great if the department could provide, you know, have additional players who could rotate in to field some of these questions. Representative Kaufman, you're in the queue.
Thank you. Through the chair to the bill sponsor, in prior discussions, we had chatted about the notion of a bypass rather than a pass-through, which would, as a possible structure to avoid the taxable impact on the donor. In other words, you're simply allocating a certain amount to bypass the transaction to you as an individual and go directly to the state as a way of minimizing the taxable event. And I was just wondering, were you able to find out any more information about that as a more beneficial tax structure for the program?
No, I really wasn't. I checked the notes and whatnot from the previous discussion, the last legislature, and it sounded like that would take quite a bit of time to figure out whether or just how you would structure that so that the individual is making the decision, but the individual doesn't have the money before they make the application, and that sounded like it was kind of complicated to put that into effect.
Thank you. I appreciate that. That might be some complicated statutory language to create that, but I guess as a desired end state, if we could get there, that may be the structure. And I just wonder if Ms. Scherer has any comment on that as a possible structure. Thank you.
Ms. Scherer.
Through the chair, I'm sorry, could you please restate the question?
Yes, ma'am. Through the chair, this is Representative Kaufman. And I was just wondering if there was a way to structure this so that rather than a taxable event to the donor, so to speak, it was simply a bypass. In other words, the would-be recipient of the permanent fund simply says, I relinquish my ownership of it, and it is allowed to go directly from the fund to the general fund.
Through the chair, Representative Kaufman, thank you for the question. I do believe we would have to check with the tax division on that.
Thank you.
And Ms. Scherer, if you or the PFD division or the tax division or the Department of Revenue in general perhaps could formally respond to the practicability of that mechanism, I think we'd appreciate it. I'll speak for myself. I personally would be interested how practicable that would be, as would Representative Kaufman. Other questions from the committee? Representative Clayman.
Just asking the same question to Ms. Scherer. I know the division reports out the total dividend plus whatever one gives to pick, click, give. Do you have any idea how they would treat a contribution to the state for purposes of that reporting?
Through the chair, Representative, are you asking for reporting to the IRS?
Exactly. What would you report to the IRS if there was a $500 dividend and $250 was given to the state? Would it still be $500 income?
Through the chair, Representative, yes, the permanent fund dividend would remain taxable 100%.
And so that would be true even if there was a full dividend paid, this example, $500, and the full $500 was returned to the state, the resident would still get a $500 income would be reported to the IRS.
Through the chair, yes, that is correct.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Further questions? Well, thank you very much, Ms. Scherer, for fielding those questions. If it's possible for DOR to respond to my office, we can distribute to members, and I think please include the sponsor as well, on the practicability of bypassing actual receipt of the dividend and sort of direct, I don't know, earmarking of what would have been a dividend to the general fund. I think we'd be very interested to know how workable that is, and then also the percentage of applicants who apply electronically versus those who do not. Seeing no further questions, we'll set aside HB 158. For further consideration until next year, although Representative Tarr may have a comment or a question.
Just, Mr. Chairman, thank you so much. The briefest comment, I just want to congratulate Representative Prox on getting 24 co-sponsors on your first bill, at least the first I've seen. That's impressive. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Very much deserved plaudits. Thank you, Representative Prox. Great first committee hearing.
Thank you.
Yes. We look forward to a second one. So that's item 3 of 5 today, and that takes us to item 4 of 5, HB 94 from Representative Foster. I believe Representative Foster is attending to our operating budget in this moment, but Mr. LeBoll is here in his stead. Welcome, Mr. LeBoll, and go ahead and put yourself on record and present HB 94.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Paul LeBoll, staff to Representative Foster. House Bill 94 would essentially add non-compete clauses to the list of unlawful acts and practices in Alaska's unfair trade practices and consumer protection statute. Essentially, many of Alaska's businesses are small, and when large companies contract with them, they are able to leverage unfavorable terms that are designed to limit competition. And House Bill 94 aims to prevent that and improve competition in Alaska's economy. The measure would apply in historically underutilized business zones established by the Hub Zone Act of 1997.
We have invited testimony from Nick Moe with a village corporation, Azacharak, although apologies if I mispronounce.
It's pronounced Azazarak.
Azazarak.
I may be incorrect, but.
We'll find out for sure. But first, Representative Tara, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And perhaps this is what the invited testifier will cover. But I was just wanting like an example to help me sort of cement in my head what this means a little bit more. If you have one, or if the invited testifier has one.
Maybe we'll go to I think the invited testifier might be able to speak to it. Let's find out. Mr. Moe, if you can hear us, please go ahead and put yourself on record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Nick Moe, and I'm the Chief Operating Officer at Azatrak Incorporated. And so I'm here to speak to this on behalf of our organization and on behalf of our CEO, President Lauren Peterson, who has a travel conflict. And I think I can speak to that a little bit, Representative Tarr, just based off our example. We are an ANCSA village corporation, and we serve 520 shareholders around Alaska, but primarily in Mountain Village. Mountain Village is located in the lower Yukon River and is the second largest village in the Kuzilvac census area. And again, I just want to take a moment to thank Representative Foster for sponsoring this bill, as well as the committee and the chair for taking time to look at this issue. And, at Azatrak, we serve our shareholders and the community in several ways. We operate the only gas station in the community. We deliver heating fuel. And we provide, dozens of scholarships and other philanthropy through our foundation. And as the largest landholder in the area, we have several properties that we lease out, both commercially and residential to residential entities as well. And one of these commercial leases that we are locked into for the last several years was agreed to by our previous board leadership and has been especially contentious. And this is with a foreign-owned company that has bullied and held our community hostage over this lease, kind of using their vast and legal resources to fight tooth and nail. And the worst element of this lease is what was mentioned, the non-compete clause. And this means that we are not allowed to sell items or similar items below the high prices set by this company at this company's store. And this lack of competition, it's not just Mountain Village. It exists a lot in much of rural Alaska, and is one of the reasons why, oftentimes things are priced so high. And that's why this bill, House Bill 94, is so needed. It will encourage competition in the free market to help drive down these high prices, help local businesses, which, in turn helps the state. And as mentioned, we have heard from several places who have been kind of forced into this lease agreement that have had to fight off a similar army of lawyers that are defending this anti-competition lease, and it puts a lot of villages in a tough situation where, their only source of reliable groceries comes from the same business. So that's why we're asking this committee to support this bill, and I think it not only the current practice not only hinders the competitive market and, kind of hurts the increased quality of goods and the free market, but it also, it stunts economic growth in some of the places where it's needed most. and it will help, I think, avoid businesses that rely on state subsidies and things like that. This is, I think, a more fiscally responsible way to go. And so I just ask that this committee and supports this bill and as a win-win for Alaska and the small businesses that are kind of bound by these non-compete clauses.
Mr. Moe, based on the description, can I take a wild guess? Is the company in question Alaska Commercial Company?
Correct.
Shocker. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just looking at their website. So it sounds like it's a situation where, you know, if the Village Corporation is leasing space where they're also trying to have some kind of small food store or general supply store, then what they're saying is they can't, they're forcing them to base their prices in that store off the prices that the, like, parent company that they're leasing from would require. Does that sound right? Am I catching that?
Yeah. Through the chair, that is correct, and with a huge markup.
Thank you.
Other questions? Seeing Representative Kaufman leaning in there.
Thank you. Through the chair, this question, I'm not sure who's best suited to answer it, but would the trade be on a level playing field if this were the case? In other words, would it be a commercial establishment competing with a commercial establishment against relatively equal supply chains? Or it's tough to protect or defend the big guy, but it's worth exploring this. Is there some unfair aspect that could be there, such as a nonprofit selling goods that would undercut a commercial operation simply because it's operating as a nonprofit, or some other configuration that would allow it lower overhead? It's complicated, but I can clarify, I guess, a bit more.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That is certainly not the intent of the legislation. I can look into that some more and get back to you. I may follow up with you after the committee to make sure I fully understand the question.
Yeah. Thank you. Through the chair, good answer. It is kind of a fuzzy question, but basically, if this bill is passed into law, will it assure equal opportunity in trade, or is there an opportunity for some other bias being built into it? So thank you very much.
Mr. Moe, are you aware of similar situations in other communities besides Mountain Village where the kind of reality you all have run headlong into also exists?
Mr. Chair, I have heard that it is almost everywhere where AC operates are facing a similar issue. And specifically our kind of our sister town, just up the river, St. Mary's, is one specific example as well.
Okay, thank you. Any additional questions from the committee? Okay. Representative Clayman.
The bill sponsor or his representative, is the intent of the bill to make the treble damages provisions of the Deceptive Trade Practices Act applicable in this instance?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The bill is drafted so that it would apply to, as with any portion of the unfair labor practices.
Unfair trade practices?
Yeah, the unlawful acts and practices under Alaska's unfair trade practices and consumer protection statutes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions, thank you very much, Mr. Lebel. Thank you very much, Mr. Moe, for making yourselves available, and we'll take this up for further consideration in the next session.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
And item 5 of 5 today on the last hearing of state affairs in the year of 2021 in the legislative session is Representative Ortez. And I do keep my word that when there will be a hearing for HB 31, there will in fact be a hearing for HB 31.
Was it that this would be the last thing we did?
There was no discussion of when the hearing would occur. But sorry, come again, Representative. Oh, I see. This is getting metaphysical. Welcome, Representative Ortiz. I believe this is the first time we've had the pleasure of your company in this committee this session. Please go ahead, put yourself on record and present the legislation.
Good afternoon. For the record, I am Representative Dan Ortiz, representing District 36, Southern Southeast Alaska. Thank you, Chair Christ-Tompkins and members of this esteemed committee for hearing House Bill 31 today. House Bill 31 establishes daylight savings time year-round. Daylight savings time is observed between the second Sunday of March and the first Sunday of November, or the time we are currently in. For example, if we were to transition fully, Mr. Chairman, to daylight savings time, and the East Coast did not, we would only be 3 hours behind during the winter months and would have the regular four-hour time difference during the summer months. There are many benefits, Mr. Chairman, to daylight savings time. I'm sure that you may not be aware, Mr. Chairman. For example, it could bring about more physical activity for our population. I think you're a supporter of that. There could be a decrease in robberies. Evidently, statistics show there could be a decrease in robberies. Increase in credit card spending on goods. Huh? There you go. Increase spending in the economy. And fewer fatal car and pedestrian crashes. Moving to full-time daily savings time requires action by the United States Congress. Congress will need to amend federal law to allow states to observe daylight savings time all year. Federal legislation has been introduced to allow that change. Mr. Chairman, nationally, there's an initiative to change to full daylight savings time. In 2020, 32 states considered daylight savings time legislation. On the West Coast, California voters authorized the change pending legislation, and both Oregon and Washington passed legislation similar to the bill before you in 2019. Year-round daylight savings time is also gaining traction in Canada. Yukon began full-time daylight savings time on March 8, 2020. British Columbia passed legislation to implement year-round daylight savings time that is contingent on the U.S. West Coast also implementing it. Because, Mr. Chairman, our close economic and geographic ties to the U.S. and Canada, West Coast Alaska can avoid being left in the dark by passing HB 31. And that's all I have for you today, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. And unless there's questions, that's what I got. Thank you for the opportunity.
There might be questions. Representative Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair to the bill sponsor. So there's two options, and I want to be sure I understand the difference. So we can never go on daylight savings time, as some advocate, or we can get on daylight savings time and stay. So if I were to look at the relative benefits, you know, two vertical columns of pluses and minuses, how would that stack up? What would the analysis be of that?
Through the chair, Representative Kaufman, it's a good question. I can say that there was a bill introduced in a previous legislature that would have put us permanently on
standard time.
Thank you. And that received pushback from different parts of our state. Particularly the tourist industry was concerned about lost daylight time in the summertime, which they now enjoy under daylight savings time, which they wouldn't if we were permanently on regular daylight savings time. Float plane operators, people like that, in dealing with the tourist industry, they saw, if we were to go to regular time, a decline in economic opportunity. Particularly, I heard more about the tourist industry. I'm sure there's others that might be impacted in other ways.
Golf course operators.
There you go. So in any case, so then to further answer your question, I believe that there would be significantly less pushback on staying on daylight savings time. However, it still would have an impact in certain communities. When I think way out there on the chain, you know, they already have a long time before daylight arrives in the morning, And this would, let's see, this would require even a longer time, but they would have a longer time in the evening, but even they'd have to wait longer in the morning for daylight to arrive if we were on daylight savings time during the winter time, for example. And so there could be some pushback from that area, but I think that the overall pushback, if you're going to choose one or the other, it would be more for remaining on standard time than on daylight savings time.
Follow up. Thank you. Through the chair. So what I'm hearing is that essentially this method of picking one, time preference over the other, aligns us better with our primary summertime marketplace activities, the tourism industry, outdoor activities, et cetera. And so, therefore, there's a financial bias towards that, as well as maybe lifestyle.
From what I've heard from my particular area,
Okay. Well, thank you.
Representative Tarr.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So remind me again what would happen in terms of the time difference. So say we've sprung forward, now we're in standard time, and when we opposite. Okay. We're in daylight savings time right now. Okay. So we stay permanently in daylight savings time instead of when we would fall back in the fall.
Right.
Okay, and so I was just trying to remember, in prior iterations of the bill, there was concern about kids in the morning, being darker in the morning when kids were going to go to school, and would that be like a safety concern? And I think the bill before was the opposite. That's what I'm trying to think. Okay, so now how... we would go into the fall. Right now, we are 4 hours different, but we would never change again, so we would be 3 hours. Is that what you said?
For part of the year, if the East Coast didn't change their situation, for part of the year, we would be a three-hour difference, and for part of the year, we'd be a four-hour difference.
Okay. So then...
so we would not roll back in the fall, and so at that point, if things stayed the same on the East Coast, they would roll back, so that would put us 1 hour closer to them in the fall time.
Okay. And then on the morning daylight issue, then when we fall back, it gets darker, so then I guess, yeah, it must have been the opposite concern, because the bill was the opposite. So that problem may not be an issue here then.
Right. I do think I'm right, though, in saying that at least out on the Aleutian Chain, where they have a late morning under our current system and they have longer nighttime times, this would even make it later during the winter times than it is now. So there would be that one issue for sure.
Representative Ortiz, are you familiar with the history of time zone law in Alaska?
Vaguely.
I'm suspicious.
Enlighten me.
My question is it within the purview of the legislature to determine what parts of the state are in what time zones?
That is a good question. I can refer to Ms. Hamp, who has spent more time on this particular bill. Do you have anything to add to that, Ms. Hamp? No? Okay. I do know that this bill is only contingent on authorization from the federal government, first of all. So there's that issue. I guess if the federal government authorizes us to make the change, well then, I guess that's providing authorization. So there's that. But at the same time, specifically to the ability for the legislature to decide time zone differences, I can't speak to that specifically.
And the reason I ask, and for the record in the future, is Alaska used to, of course, have multiple time zones as
right.
Sort of periodically, nostalgically referenced. And believe the legislature, or my understanding is that the legislature consolidated those time zones, which makes me think that somehow or in some fashion we have that ability. And one of the tensions with any time DST or standard time related legislation as part of the state wins and part of the state loses, wins, loses is relative, but I'm just curious how that other dimension comes into play. Representative Klayman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the short answer to the question of the chair is that the states have to get approval from the federal government, but the federal government tends to give that because there's states, for example, Arizona is one that never goes on daylight savings time, and there's portions, I believe, of Idaho, and driving through Idaho can be quite confusing because you're not really waiting for the next border that might be not on daylight savings. It's portions of this. I think it's Idaho that some are on daylight savings time and some are not. And I think what happens is the state has to take the action, but then the federal government has to approve. But I don't think there's any history of the federal government declining to approve.
That's helpful. Other questions, Representative Kaufman?
Comment, if I may. I know from past debates on this issue that sometimes it's the financial industries or others that have very strong ties with the East Coast or other domains that they have concern about confusion around that or being time shifted, you know, an hour difference. So I do know that that will come up, and we get to having commentary. It might be good to include some folks in those industries or others that are similarly situated with time zones.
Right.
Thank you.
Yes, absolutely.
Further questions or comments?
It fascinates me, Mr. Chairman. This topic fascinates me. I feel there's been a bill every year I've been in the legislature, but we haven't passed one yet. But it's a fascinating topic.
Just, my mother told me, Representative Tarr, you just keep getting up on the horse and you just try it again.
Well, seeing no further questions, we're all getting a little bit rummy. That's item 5 of 5 on the agenda, and that's the last state affairs hearing of 2021 in the regular session. But as far as that qualifier on the end, it is my hope, actually, to convene the committee through the interim. I think in particular on the subject of elections, House Bill 66, House Bill 95, Representative Hopkins has a pre-registration bill. I know Representative Eastman, who's not with us today, has expressed interest in working on that bill with Representative Hopkins. And so I think there will be a nexus of work to consider and perhaps other issues as well. So I'm excited to make up for the month of lost time at the front end of the session and work through the interim to give us a running start into 2022. But thank you, everybody, for a great session. And Nate, I know you were only with us for a couple of hearings, but thank you, and huge thanks to Sophia on Line with House Records, and of course Jeff Stepp, who very capably facilitated the committee through the duration of session. So at 4:19 p.m. We are adjourned.